Welcome to World War I Centennial News. It's about World War I news 100 years ago this week, and it's about World War I now, news and updates about the centennial and the commemoration. World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Today is February 15th, and our host is Teresa Sims. Hi, Teresa. How you doing?
I'm well. Hi, Teo. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Great. And so today I want to thank you first off for joining us. We are recording live from Washington, D.C. in the studio at the World War I Centennial Commission. I have Chris Christopher with me, and we'll hear more from him later. So first, let's start off with 100 years ago this week. Last week, we highlighted the sinking of the U.S. ship Housatania at the hands of a German submarine. Now this week, we look back even further than 100 years ago, and on February 17, 1864, we find that the USS Housatania was sunk off the coast of Charleston, South Carolina, by a Confederate submarine. This was the first ship sunk by a submarine in history. Our researcher found this, and it's truly a real odd coincidence, and there's more you can read about this at the link on the chat room. Last week, we talked about how Eric Ludendorff halted the construction of any new Hindenburg plants. This week, we have a similar story. We show that Britain ended all construction of capital naval ships. At this stage of the war, there is a shortage of resources, which forced the Germans to halt construction of their own capital ships. The British had maintained an advantage in this area, and so they halted construction as well. On February 8th, the War Cabinet canceled the construction of three new battle cruisers, only letting work on the Hood proceed as planned. So it looks like, just in summary, everybody's running out of money. And if you're interested in how the financing affected World War I, we have this fantastic lecture by Professor Jennifer Siegel, and she presented her work at the OSU Lecture on Financing the War last fall. And you can go to our website or this link in the chat room and get more information both on the article as well as her presentation. Okay, Germany's submarine campaign in the Atlantic may have soured relations with the U.S., but a path to peace still existed. Emperor Charles of Austria refused to break off relations with the United States, despite being asked personally by Kaiser Wilhelm. Charles still sought a negotiated peace and knew that it would be too difficult without the United States. Unfortunately, Germany refused to cease unrestricted submarine warfare. The article is a great read. Follow the link. This week on the Great War Channel, they have four new episodes instead of three. The first is reconstructive and plastic surgery during World War I. Second, Bulgaria digs in at Doron, which was the former Macedonia. The third, the year of battles comes to an end. And finally, you know, a couple weeks ago, Florian Wittig and the Great War Channel team took a trip to Verdun. They told us when we spoke with them last week that seeing all those crosses at Verdun was very moving and very profound. And they published a recap of their trip. Check it out. Next, let's find out what's happening this week in the skies over Europe in today's War in the Sky segment. Teo, take it away.
We have three quick stories from the Great War in the Sky 100 years ago this week. The first story is from February 8, 1917. Flying a Spad 7, French ace Georges Guynemer becomes the first Allied pilot to shoot down a German heavy bomber when he downs a Gotha G2. The next story comes from the website Today in World War I. It's February 11, 1917. It also involves bombers. You know, Zeppelins generally tried to raid Britain at night. The Brits responded with powerful searchlights and incendiary ammunition that allowed them to track the machine gun fire in the dark skies. But the new fixed-wing bombers on both sides made for faster, smaller targets, especially at night. So it was on February 11 that a German fighter shot down two French bombers returning from a night raid near their landing field in Mezzeville, France, making this the first example of an air-to-air shootdown at night. Our last story is of another first, but not from combat. from Pensacola, Florida, on February 13, 1917. U.S. Marine Corps aviator Francis Thomas Evans Sr. was flying a Curtiss N9 floatplane, you know, the kind with the seaplane with the pontoons, and he performs an aerobatic loop, making him the first person in history to loop a seaplane. Everyone thought that this was impossible in an N9, even the manufacturer. This is not perhaps the most dramatic moment, but Americans were working on their own tricks, getting ready for the war in the sky. And in fact, Evans later becomes known for a method of pulling out of a spin after a stall. Now, this is a technique that was still taught by the Civil Air Patrol when I learned to fly in the 60s, and is probably still taught today. And that's how it was in the skies 100 years ago this week.
Thanks, Teo. Where do you get your information when you're doing your research? Because it's always fascinating what you're reporting.
Well, the stories come either from R.G. Head's curated timeline that we have on the website, or sometimes I'll get that as a lead story, and we'll find other stories in other places from other websites. Thanks.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Next, we have Mike Schuster in the Great War Project blog. Mike, welcome. What's the headline this week?
Thank you, Teresa. It's good to be with you. The headlines this week: bitter recriminations among the Allies, Russia in turmoil, alarm in Paris and London. And this is special to the Great War Project. A century ago, the Germans now prepared to face the might of the United States, writes historian Martin Gilbert. But their defensive actions on the Western Front, where the German war effort is potentially at serious risk, was offset by the continual news from Russia of military weakness and anti-war feeling. One top German commander writes in his diary a century ago, "It would seem that Russia cannot hold out longer than the autumn." At this moment, hundreds of Russians are protesting the war in the streets of Petrograd. The British military observers with the Russian army report to London that as many as 3 million Russian soldiers have been killed. Recriminations among the Allies, writes historian David Stone, were especially bitter in these days a century ago. The British and French want a Russian commitment to an early offensive, but the Russians keep putting off the planning. There was understandable alarm in Paris and London, reports historian Stone, which feared war weariness in Russia understandably. The British observers report that Russia may not be able to field enough fresh troops to face expected military losses in 1917. There was little common ground, reports Stone, on which the two Allies could agree. Relations between the Allies and Russia are rapidly deteriorating. Nevertheless, the Russian Tsar still has dreams of expanding his empire to annex Constantinople and the nearby straits, still under the control of the Ottoman Turks. All the Allies are still maneuvering to acquire territory of their adversaries. In mid-February a century ago, secret agreements are still on the table. On February 12th, writes historian Gilbert, the Russian government sought a further secret assurance with regard to its western frontier. It proposed doing so by giving France a free hand with regard to the German frontier. At this moment a century ago, the Russians and the French are in agreement about territories they will occupy when the war ends. Gilbert writes, on that day, the Russian government accepted in strictest secrecy that Alsace-Lorraine, occupied by Germany since 1871, would be restored to France. This secret agreement also gives to France alone the power to determine the border with Germany after the war. Overlooked in all this secret maneuvering, Gilbert writes, it was becoming almost impossible for many Russian officers to maintain military discipline. In one notable case, Russian cavalrymen are issued live ammunition and ordered to break up an anti-war demonstration. Instead, the cavalry squadron addresses the demonstrators, many soldiers among them. The Russian people, one soldier on horseback hollers, want an end to the slaughter of an imperialist war. They want peace, land, and liberty. The speaker also called for an end to the Russian monarchy. Throughout the Eastern Front, writes Gilbert, the Bolsheviks were appealing to the soldiers not to fight and to join soldiers' committees to uphold and propagate revolutionary demands. The United States was not yet in the war, reports Gilbert, and Russia was in turmoil. And that's the news from the battlefield this week from the Great War Project.
Thank you, Mike. And, you know, with a combination of all these stories, we really have a great picture of what's going on in 1917 in those days leading up to the U.S. entering into World War One. And that event will be marked in April 6 in Kansas City with a signature event, as well as throughout the nation at various state organizations. Okay, here's a headline from Britain. London Jewish Children's Experience of the Great War. The Liberal Jewish Synagogue is releasing a series of illustrated poems, essays, and cartoons in two bound volumes of work by pupils of the school who attended there in 1915 and 1916. The material had been gathering dust in storage boxes until discovered by Sharon Lewison. She's a former archivist at the St. John's Wood Shul. The volumes are showpiece in the London Jewish Chronicles, We Were There Too, website. Very interesting. And the illustrations are just, they're timeless. Elsewhere in the UK, the headlines read, do you have space to put up special posters commemorating World War One? This article from Huddersfield Daily Examiner is about a project commemorating stories of local soldiers who fought in the war. The stories have been gathered from local people and have been turned into 20 different posters that will be on display for commuters to and from the Huddersfield bus station and Dewsbury railway station. This is a great idea. It's one that's easily adopted in any community, and asking veterans to put up their posters commemorating World War One, and it doesn't have to be limited to veterans, of course, but working with veteran organizations would be a logical place to start. But it's an interesting idea. Definitely could get some traction in local communities. Next, we have some new posts and articles to bring to your attention. The U.S. World War I Centennial Commission is preparing for the major signature event on April 6, 2017, to mark the 100th anniversary of America's entry into the war. Commissioner Chair Robert D'Alessandro spoke to us about the significance of the date. He's a career historian, and he gave us some perspective on the events that took place 100 years ago to put us on the path to war, and how those events changed the entire world. Head over to the Commission's website to read more on what he has to say. We also have another interview available for you this week. This one features Native American graphic artist Chag Lowry. Chag has a particular interest in telling the story of World War One due to the amazing things that he's learned about the Native American soldiers who served in the U.S. military during that time. He has a new graphic novel about World War One coming out entitled Soldiers Unknown, and he took some time to tell us about it. Don't miss this one. The next post is about the history of the military newspaper Stars and Stripes. The paper was created as a morale builder after Americans surged into France during World War One, and has a shared history with the New Yorker magazine. I've lived in Germany several years and never knew this, that it was connected to the New Yorker. To see the full post, to learn more about the origins of the Stars and Stripes, follow the link in the chat room. This week on the 100 Cities and 100 Memorials blog, the moderators are answering your questions. Many of you have reached out to the blog for more information, and the questions and answers to those inquiries are now posted for the benefit of all. If you're working on this project, these are great questions. If you have a question of your own, check out the blog this week and you might find it's already been answered. If not, please submit your question and our moderators will be happy to get back to you with an answer. From our W. Wright blog, this week we have Major Jasmine Modipulli, and she reflects upon the roles of African American women during World War One, especially the actions of journalist, activist, and suffrage Ida B. Wells. Today we have special guests from the Commission. My colleague Chris Christopher is here to talk about our Stories of Service section on the site.
Happy to be here.
Well, please tell us more about Family Ties.
Certainly. Family Ties is a section on the website, and the principle behind this is that everybody alive today has a personal connection to World War One, because obviously you had an ancestor alive during that time. Most people don't feel that connection to World War One, but once we make that personal family connection to them, it piques their interest and they start looking for more there. The main thing we want to talk about today is the Stories of Service section of the Family Ties section of the website. So many people today don't really have an understanding of the fact that someone in their family did serve in the war, and when they discover this, they may find photos, they may find diaries, They may find information about this person, and perhaps they heard stories that their grandfather or great-grandfather told them about the war. And we have a place here where you can actually bring and post that information and those photos of the service that your ancestor did in the war. And the purpose of this is to put this on record. Lots of folks alive today had conversations, direct conversations, with people who served in the war, and some of them simply have second-person recollections. And this is a place to record all of those now, and to recognize the service these individuals who served in the war, and to make sure that the personal memories of people alive today are still available when the bicentennial comes around later on. So it's a very simple process. You go to the Submit a Story of Service form, and it's just very simple to actually fill out the form. You put in who you are, what sort of person you are who's submitting the story, and your name, and then the name of the veterans, where they served, what years they served. If you know, you don't have to know. You just know that they served. Description of their service, everything that you know about them, and then you can upload some photographs. Very simple and straightforward. The interesting thing is the wide variety of inputs we're getting. If we go back to the family, to the Stories of Service page, you can see the very first article on there. Mary Cohen Riley Ravener is her name, and she was one of the very first women Marines who got their start, actually, in World War I. And this was written by her her grandson, who's a writer, and wrote this long article about her. And then it goes on and on about how her service in the war affected her life and the rest of her life. And then as you scroll on down, there's Clement Anthony Grummel, and you see Corporal Harry Shenton. Corporal Harry Shenton is actually an interesting fellow. He was a famous graphic artist, and throughout the war, he did drawings in a sketchbook of his experiences in the war, and they were just recently published as a book.
I was just curious, Chris, about how many people or about how many of these stories do you have on the site at this point?
That's a good question. Dozens, certainly, and there are more coming in every day as more people are hearing about this. But the sky is the limit in terms of the number that we want to have, because truly this is an opportunity to permanently record your ancestors' stories of service in the permanent record of the Centennial Commission. I wanted to point out that while 5 million Americans served in the armed forces during the war, millions of others served in industry and in farms, and people in both the northern part of the country and the southern part of the country raised horses for the Army's replenishment squadrons that sent horses to Europe. And there's as many stories out there as there are families out there, and we really want to encourage families to put those stories up. As you saw on the submission form, is we have a whole list of different categories of people who can submit things. I think the Stories of Service is a wonderful project for school classrooms, for example. In most cities, there's a World War I memorial. The classrooms could go out to the memorial, get a list of names, and do some research. Find if the families of those folks are still local, get the pictures, and put up stories of service on these people, making that connection there. Retirement homes and senior care facilities. This would be a good project for them as well, because many of the people in there who are in their late 80s and 90s are the sons and daughters of people who served in the war. And they have first-person memories of their father or mother, or grandmother, grandfather, who served in the war. And those first-person memories, we're going to lose all of those here in the next few years. And so this is a great opportunity for organizations that deal with elderly people on a regular basis to help capture those memories.
Thanks, Chris. And so, Chris, if you want to do research on this, what's the best way?
Yeah, go to the Family Ties page, and there's all sorts of resources there. If you had an ancestor who was in the service, we have links to various genealogical resources. Our Documenting Doughboys section is some specific articles from a former NARA researcher on how to look for your family's military service, and probably best ways to do it is go digging back in the family photographs that you have stored somewhere in a box in your attic or basement.
Thank you, Chris. This is a fascinating program you've got going there. Thank you so much. So now let's go spotlight in the media. The Pritzker Military Museum and Library has a literature award for lifetime achievement in military writing, and the deadline for submission is next month on the 3rd of March. This is a very prestigious award. It serves to recognize a living author who has made a significant contribution to the understanding of military history, including military affairs. The award includes a citation, medallion, and a $100,000 prize. The Pritzker Military Museum and Library is one of the founding members of the World War I Centennial Commission, and we're so excited to see who they choose to win. If you think you know someone who should be nominated, follow the link in the chat room to get more information. Next, we have information from the veterans community. American Legion Post 43, and that's the Hollywood post in California, they're stepping up their World War I commemoration efforts. They are not only restoring a memorial in Elysian Park, but they are also having an event where historian R.G. Head will speak. They are working with the DAR to restore this memorial, and they've also teamed up with California World War I Task Force, and rumor has it they are collaborating with actor John Voight on a future project. So good luck. Our fingers are crossed for you. This is very exciting news, and we wish you continued success, and keep letting us know what's going on. Let's see what's going on in the world of social media. Kathy Akey is our social media director, and she's with us today to give us some highlights from the conversation wall. Kathy?
Hi. It has been a very exciting week on our social media accounts. Of course, we have loved watching Indie Night L and all the guys at the Great War traveling around France and watching their adventures. We've been reposting some of their posts on social media that are of interest. But I wanted to focus on two in particular for this week. The first being a Valentine's Day post. There is this really incredible group out of Europe called Europeana Transcribeathon. And much like our Stories of Service, they are crowdsourcing transcriptions. And one special project they're working on is love letters from World War I. You can go on their website and transcribe letters in Russian and French and English, whatever language you speak, and you can help them document them for posterity. They've completed over 2,000 documents already, over 2,000 different letters, and are currently, there's transcribers working on another 1,500, but they're only a small fraction of the way through. So if that sounds like something of interest to people to connect really directly with this history, I think that's such a useful, amazing, and fun thing to go do. So it's well worth checking out. The other social media post I wanted to focus on was sort of a surprise success. Of course, it's still February, so we're still focusing a bit on the African Americans who served in World War I in all shapes and sizes. And some of those people who are the best supporters of our veterans and our soldiers are their parents. So we came across this photo of a man named Ike Sims from Atlanta, Georgia. He was 87 years old when the picture was taken, and you notice he's holding up two paddles with a total of 11 stars, each star representing a son of his in the service in World War I. And apparently he had three other sons who were too young to be in the war quite yet and were eager to go. But you can just see the pride on his face, and people responded incredibly to this. It got over 400 shares on Facebook. Some 30,000 people ended up being touched by this photo through Facebook and social media, and it just makes me so happy to see that this image of this man full of pride for his son's service touched so many people. So for me, that was a major, major highlight for the week. And of course, we thank him and all of his children for their service.
Thank you, Kathy. That's amazing. And Ike Sims with 11 children serving. That's and the thought that we would not recognize that, it is unbelievable. So I really appreciate you finding that information and sharing it with us today. And we look forward to more posts in the future. So this is our show for today. Thank you very much for joining us today. We've had a very interesting show, and again, we thank you for all that you're doing in the field, in your state, your organization, to help commemorate and honor the sacrifice of the nearly 5 million American veterans who served during World War I. It's Teresa Sims, and I'm signing out.
World War I Centennial News is brought to you by the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission and the Commission's founding sponsor, the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The videos can be found at ww1cc.org/cn. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, The Weekly Dispatch. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are both at ww1cc and on Facebook at ww1centennial. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to commemorate. So long.